So anyway, we turn our attention to the Huskies and the Seahawks. Obviously, a rough weekend for both of them. And I think that we want to talk about both teams because they're really similar games that each team played. They were different but similar, and I think that the kind of the theme of both of those games was missed opportunities.
Obviously, both teams 4-0, playing games that we knew would be difficult. In the Huskies' case, far and away their most difficult game of the season. Seahawks' case, you could make that argument. It's a little less clear. And a chance to win both of those and go to 5-0 and really be the toast of their respective leagues in many ways, and came up just a little bit short.
And I think you would definitely say that the Colts are the best team that the Seahawks, or at least the most difficult game that the Seahawks have played. Right now they're 4th in DVOA in Football Outsiders, and you're playing them on the road. Basically, you would expect the 2nd best team in DVOA to lose to the 4th best team in DVOA on the road.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit different because of the fact that there's such a big gap. There's basically right now in DVOA, it's the Broncos, and then there's a big gap to the Seahawks, and then there's a big gap to everyone else, which, you know, I think reflects kind of how the season has gone. But obviously, yeah, not a disappointing loss in any way, I would say.
But there were definitely some positives to take. I wanted to come on here and be depressed the whole time and complain about how the college football needs a playoff, about how terrible the NFL refereeing is, things like that. We may get to that. But there are definitely some positives to take from it, and that's, I think, both teams outplayed their counterparts this weekend. The Seahawks' yards per play was 6.3 to 5.3 to the Colts. They outgained Indianapolis 423 yards to 317. Meanwhile, the Huskies at Stanford had 5.5 yards per play compared to 4.5, which is pretty dismal for Stanford.
Yeah.
And then they outgained Stanford 489 yards to 279.
So there's obviously something important that's missing from those two figures, which is special teams. And that's really what doomed the Huskies in terms of giving up long returns to Montgomery, one for a touchdown, one that set up a touchdown. And their average start position was so much better than the Huskies that that basically turned the game. And then obviously in the Indianapolis game, you have two special teams play that swung the game. Number one, the Seahawks blocking the punt and having that being called a safety.
And I want to talk about that later.
We'll come back to that, yeah. And then the field goal that was blocked and returned for a touchdown by the Colts, that ended up a 10-point swing. You change that, the Seahawks probably go on to win, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's definitely some positives to take from the games. At the time, it didn't feel like there were any positives. I mean, really,
I felt positive about the Stanford game.
We're at a point with both of these teams where there are no moral victories. Moral victories are over. We needed to win those games. It's not a matter of, we're not a former 0-12 team anymore in the Huskies. We needed to win that game. It's not about feeling good about ourselves anymore.
I still think the Huskies made a statement, and when you look at the context of the entire season, I feel a lot better about going to play at Arizona State in 2 weeks, at UCLA down the road, based on the fact that they played a really, really, really good team, even.
Honestly, in college football, making a statement doesn't mean anything, though, because it's so all or nothing. Each game, winning or losing, is all that matters. So if you lose the game, you're basically screwed for the rest of the season now.
And one of the questions that did come up was, if you could only have won one of those games, would you rather have had it the Huskies win or the Seahawks win? And the answer to that is pretty clearly the Huskies.
Obviously.
Because the Seahawks loss doesn't really affect their goals long-term that much. The Huskies changes that, those aspirations.
I agree. The thing that the Seahawks have going for them is that we play New Orleans, who seem to be kind of the biggest competitors right now to the number one seed in the NFC. Getting them at home is a pretty big deal.
Yep.
The
other thing is the schedule the rest of the way now looks remarkably easy. Football Outsiders rated it 31st in terms of remaining schedule.
There are a couple of games that
collapsing.
Yeah, that
Giants.
Looked like they were hard games before the season. Tampa Bay coming here and Tennessee seemed like they might be interesting games. And now they're starting Ryan Fitzpatrick and Mike Glennon. And Atlanta is probably going to be without Julio Jones. And they're without much of their defense. Potentially Steven Jackson. And the Giants are the second worst team in the league.
But that's all in the future, so to get back to Saturday and Sunday, what else stood out to you similar to those two games?
Definitely the refereeing. I think that basically any 50-50 call, almost every 50-50 call in those two games, went to the Huskies or Seahawks opponent. The Seahawks had 7 penalties for 85 yards, compared to Indianapolis, who had 3 penalties for 35 yards. And then the Huskies were penalized 10 times for 89 yards, Stanford 7 for 48. So almost a similar amount of penalties, but the yardage that came from that was so different, where Stanford's getting a couple of 5-yard penalties and the Huskies are getting these big chunks.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts on that. First, one of the interesting thoughts I had during the Stanford game, just listening to the broadcast, is how different we treat officiating in football from basketball. Because in basketball, there's a lot of talk about, like, if there's an imbalanced number of foul calls, people use that as evidence of biased refereeing. And there's been studies that show a tendency by referees to try to kind of even out the foul count. But no one does that, I don't think, in football. It's basically everyone says, hey, stop committing these penalties. And I
don't think that's the case right now. On Saturday in that Husky game.
For Husky fans or for national media who are objective about the issue? Because those are two different
national
issues.
National media was very questionable about the refereeing.
They were questionable about the refereeing in general, I would say, in the Seahawks-Colts game. But I think that only the review at the end of the Huskies game, I don't think they really questioned.
People turn it on at the very end. No one's watching when Bishop Sankey's getting an insane clipping call.
I suppose, but the Huskies and Seahawks have been getting penalties all year long. The Huskies came in, again, number one in the country in penalty yardage.
We're number one.
Yes, we are number one, which I don't really personally have an issue with. I don't think studies show that it's not a bad thing to get penalties if you're making aggressive plays.
Absolutely.
Because of it. So I'm not really that worried about it. But I don't think also you can use it as evidence that the referees are biased against us.
Do you want something that is evidence that the referees are biased against us? Most notably, Lan Clark, who is the worst referee we have ever seen.
Well, Lan Clark loves to hear himself talk.
He is he's the epitome of hashtag Pac-12 refs.
Actually, I guess he does it. Sean Hockley loves to hear himself talk. Lan Clark likes to make calls. He doesn't necessarily talk that much after that.
He loves to be really excited when he says that the ball hit the ground. But basically, there were these two 50-50 calls. Honestly, on either of them, I don't know. I think, obviously, I think I saw the most self-serving things to see.
Oh, really?
Which is the Jaron Johnson recovering the ball in the end zone, which would have meant 7 points instead of two in the Seahawks game. And then, obviously, the Kevin Smith catch at the end of the Husky game. Or non-catch. And in both of these instances, it looked like they were 50-50 calls, and they both went against the Huskies, kind of for opposite reasons. One, you would assume if it's a 50-50 call, you would stick with the ruling on the field. And the other one, which was of a catch in the Kevin Smith case, and in the other one, if it's a 50-50 call, you would assume that they stick with the ruling on the field, which they did in the Colts game. And both of these instances went against the Huskies and the Seahawks. And honestly, before you say whatever you're going to say, I think...
You know I'm going to disagree with you.
I think that it meant that both of these teams lost the game. You said that earlier, that if the Seahawks go up 17-0, that lead is way more insurmountable than a 12-0 lead.
I think that's definitely possible.
And if the Huskies... I mean, the Huskies had a lot of, dare I say, momentum going forward. They had a timeout left. They had plenty of time. They would have had at least four chances to look for the end zone and probably still hit the game-tying field goal. And at that point, the Stanford defense was so exhausted that you would assume they'd be able to score in overtime.
I wouldn't necessarily say the Huskies would have won that game, but I would say it definitely swung. I mean, obviously it swung the outcome. The game they had a very good chance of at the very least forcing overtime, especially because I believe less in the momentum, but I just don't think Stanford could cover UW's receivers, and I don't think they can do that all day.
And the receivers were beating themselves. Austin Seferian Jenkins dropping that catch on that series, and then Kason Williams also not coming up with the catch. There were two catches that they had in their hands, including the Smith catch also.
It could have, yeah.
Three out of the four, the receivers had the ball on their hands or in their hands and were ruled incomplete. Either completely dropped them or were ruled incomplete, questionably.
I mean, I would say I think I saw what the referees saw in both instances on that call. In the Kevin Smith case, I think there's a frame where you see the football on the grass and his hands are not underneath it, which they would need to be.
Do you see it so conclusively that you would overturn the call on the field jovially?
I don't know if I would do it jovially, no. I don't know. I don't think it was a 50-50 call, though. I think it was more like a 60-40 call or a 40-60 call, depending on what perspective you are. And the other thing that happened here is both of those close calls went to the home team, which I think is historically what happens. I don't know if anyone studied that on reviews, but I've got to imagine that there's a home field advantage there. Because you're not going to be jovial if you're announcing, oh, hey, your team just lost the game to the home fans, but if you're not saying, oh, hey, your team just won the game, then you're pretty jovial. So I can understand why there's a home field bias
after
on
reviewing the play. The ball hit the ground. That's my best Lan Clark impression. I'll say that this weekend, sometimes when you're at the games, it's hard to tell in college who the referee is, unless it's Jay Strickers, because he's very noticeable because of his glasses. In the NFL, they go out of their way to tell you who the refereeing crew is because it's a professional league and they're not trying to hide these sort of things. But so it's hard to tell. But if before the game we see that the referee is Lan Clark, I'm not going to be assuming that the Huskies have any chance against Oregon. When we talk about chances of victory later, if I say 10% or whatever, then it's going to go down to zero.
Well, I don't think they're going
to have... There's the with Lan Clark caveat, which takes it to zero no matter what. In the Seahawks game, if Lan Clark pops up, back to zero.
Wow. Tennessee guaranteed victory in Seattle if Lan Clark referees. Yeah, I guess I got nothing to add.
I tried to look up historical information for Lan Clark refereeing Husky games, but the internet just doesn't have this sort of thing readily available.
Is it on? It's not on the box score?
No, it's not on the box score, who the referees are.
It must be somewhere. I bet we can find this for next week. Anyway, I don't think they would have him do two Husky games in a row. That would be pretty exceedingly odd.
They better not. Also, when you Google Lan... I have a lot of feelings about Lan Clark. When you Google Lan Clark, very little comes up. There should be tons of information. When you search on Twitter, almost nothing about Lan Clark comes up. Only you tweeting about how bad Lan Clark is pops up.
Well, I just don't think that most people take the time to name their referees because of the same thing you just mentioned, that they don't go as far out of their way.
His name is Lan Clark.
It's a funny name. I have all sorts of what if by land, what if by sea, two if by sea jokes about Lan Clark, and they are all hilarious.
Yeah, those are really funny. So anyway, enough of talking about the Huskies and the Seahawks in general. And we'll move toward discussing more specifically the Husky game.
It's Oregon week.
I had one thing that I wanted to say, which was, so the football season, Seattle started as a Seahawks town. It'll end as a Seahawks town. But I think right now, Seattle is a Husky town coming up with this game. College game day coming here. It's the biggest ticket in Seattle, bigger than Tennessee this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it's always harder to be a Husky town than a Seahawks town because there's lots of people here who are just not going to root for the Huskies ever. There are Oregon fans here. I don't know if you knew that.
They walk among us.
But whereas the Seahawks can unite us much more easily. But yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely the much bigger game. The game day really adds an element of excitement to this that, on top of the fact that it's Washington, Oregon, the first time ever coming here, and, you know, it seals this as the biggest game of the weekend.
So tell me about Oregon.
They're very good at football. I don't know if you're aware of that. They've been, you know, typically dominant so far this season. Breaking them down statistically, they're number two in offensive S&P from Football Outsiders, college statistics, number two in rushing, number 10 in passing, which is actually kind of surprising that they're so low as number 10 in passing, because Marcus Mariota might be the best quarterback in the country. He's number two in ESPN's QBR that they've rolled out this season for college football players.
Who's number one?
Who is number one? Let me double check this. But the important thing is that he's number two in rushing QBR is the interesting thing about that. So he's not a bad passer whatsoever. He's very good at passing. He's, you know, top 25 or top 50 in the country in that. But really, his ability to do both is what sets him apart. And then if you add those together, number one is Bryce Petty from Baylor, who is scoring 70 points a game. So that makes sense.
Yeah. Do you think that Marcus Mariota running the ball will be affected by DeAnthony Thomas potentially not playing? And also Colt Laierla leaving the Oregon team?
I don't know. They've just been rolling on. I mean, I think that's part of what makes Oregon so good at this point is that they're not dependent on one player. You know, they have incredible depth, and they have so many good athletes, so many talented players, and then you put them in that system and force teams to choose among who they're going to defend. And I think you put almost anyone in that system, and they're a dangerous player. And it doesn't have to just be DeAnthony Thomas. I mean, obviously, he takes them to the next level, but, you know, you've got two other guys, Byron Marshall and Thomas Tyner, averaging about 6 yards a carry.
So one of the things that we looked at in that Stanford game last week was that the Huskies really limited their running backs. They held all of their primary rushers to under 4 yards per carry. And so the Huskies are very good at stopping the run right now. Do you think that that's going to translate to the way that Oregon plays offense, though?
I think it'll be a little different because so what we saw Stanford, where they did have success, it was some end-arounds, things like that, where they were able to get the ball on the edge, Hogan keeping the ball, getting out to the edge, because the Huskies were so focused up the middle. And you don't have to do that quite the same way as much sellout up the middle against Oregon because they're not going to put 9 offensive linemen in the game and just try to ram it down your throats. But You know, I think that's where it's going to be a much different threat, because they can do so much in terms of stretching the field horizontally with their speed. So I think the Huskies are much better positioned to stop that than they have been in recent years. That's, again, where we've seen the outside linebackers, Shaq Thompson, Princeton Fuimoano, have been terrific at chasing down those
players. Travis Feeney, I felt, had a great game last week.
He had a phenomenal
game. We talked about
game.
Shaq Thompson last week, but I feel like Travis Feeney was the player of the game. At least defensively.
Came up with a lot of big plays on third down, whether it was chasing down Hogan in the pocket or deflecting away passes when he was used in coverage. So, yeah, he had a terrific game.
Are there any secrets to beating Oregon that you can see? Is there any weakness? You've looked at them statistically. Is there any weakness to Oregon?
Well, the surprise, everyone's talking about how this year Oregon has a defense that's just as good as their offense in terms of, you know.
So the secrets to beating Oregon are another one of their strengths?
Allow me to finish. The secret to beating Oregon is to have Marcus Mariota come up with an obscure injury or illness on the day of the game. No. Anyway, they're allowing, you know, like 4.2 yards per play, I think, so far this season defensively. But when you look at the advanced metrics, they don't rate nearly as well. At S&P, they're number 29 defensively, 5th in rushing defense, 27th in passing defense, which, if your weakness is 27th, it's probably not much of a weakness, but that's the relative thing that they're not as good at. And they haven't faced very good offenses so far. Tennessee is the only top 70 in the nation offense they've played thus far. You know, Cal struggled with turnovers in that game, had like 5 fumbles in the first half. Virginia is one of the worst offenses among all the FBS teams in the country. So it's really only Tennessee that they face that's challenged them whatsoever. And I think they're going to get a much tougher test from Keith Price in this offense.
And do you think that this might be the week, and we can talk about this for the crazy comment of the week, which is something you want to implement.
I do. Well, you called me to task on my crazy comment last week, so I feel it's only fair.
Do you want to do that right now?
Yeah, after the game, you declared that Austin Seferian Jenkins should be used as an offensive lineman because of the fact that he's struggling as a receiver.
I stand by it.
Even though he was clearly one of the three, there were only 3 tight ends in the country that were like dangerous receiving threats last year, and ASJ was one of those guys. And I think to the extent that he's had a weaker season, it's just because of the fact that the Huskies have so many options that they've almost kind of forgotten about ASJ a little bit.
Do you think that this game might be one of the games where he kind of breaks out, or?
I mean, you're definitely going to be in a lot more third and, you know, medium situations, I think, against Oregon. You're not going to be just continually running for first downs or picking up, you know, first and second downs, which we saw against Stanford. I kind of thought he was going to have a big game against Stanford, and he didn't. He didn't have a bad game necessarily, other than that costly drop at the end, but he didn't have a big game.
No, he was definitely kind of a non-factor in the offense. I suppose that targeting one person and saying they're going to have a big game with the Huskies is pretty difficult when you have so many different threats.
And I think that's also an aspect of the up-tempo offense. It's a little bit more democratic because you're looking for matchups more than you are looking for a specific player.
So any other thoughts on Oregon? And then also, what do you think the chances are of winning?
I actually think they're kind of decent. So if you look at Sagarin's ratings, Oregon is number 2 in the country. And they're rated very well, but the difference between them and Stanford is less than the difference from home field advantage playing on the road at Stanford as opposed to playing at home. So they're saying that this is actually an easier game than last week's game, and that would imply that you have somewhere around 40% chance of winning. Also, FEI, Football Outsiders, other drive-based college metric, says now that Stanford is the number 1 team in the country, and Oregon is, I think, number 7. So, you know,
where did the Huskies rank in there?
I believe 11th. But this is a much more difficult test, like I said, than Oregon has faced this year. You know, the Huskies are rated in Sagarin as 13 points better than Tennessee, and that was also a game that was played at home as opposed to on the road, which is about an 8-point swing. So that's a 21 point more difficult. Now, they beat Tennessee by like 45. So there is that. But statistically speaking, the 10.5 point spread that favors Oregon is actually a little high.
Do you think there's a chance of crowd noise affecting the game? I mean, my chances of winning are much lower than yours. Do you think there's a chance? Marcus Mariota, he's played in difficult situations before, but maybe nothing quite this difficult. They played at Stanford last year, correct, and lost that game. And Mariota was pretty bad in that game.
No, that was at home last year.
They lost
They're
at
playing
home.
At Palo Alto this year.
I thought they played 2 in a row at Stanford. So they lost at home to Stanford.
I think that's what made it so notable, was that they lost at home to Stanford, yeah.
But do you think that there's any chance of crowd noise affecting Mariota, especially since they haven't played anybody particularly notable for the season so far?
I mean, they've played their, his hardest road games would be at USC last year and then at Oregon State. So, you know, I don't know. It's just the Oregon offense is not designed for that to be an issue. I wouldn't say it's going to be any more of a factor than just the typical thing. But I think what will be important is the Huskies have to get off to a good start and keep the crowd in it.
Absolutely.
Because if they struggle, then everyone's going to go, oh, here we go again. That's 10th consecutive loss to Oregon. And Husky fans are very defeatist in that way. It's like Seahawks fans, if the team started slowly, they would just be like, we're, you know, setting up the most amazing comeback.
The Seahawks did go undefeated at home last year.
Obviously.
They have not lost by 40 points to Oregon semi-recently.
This is all true. I agree with all that. But there was so much grumbling in the stands 2 years ago against Oregon, I remember.
We went into that game pretty excited, and then Oregon throttled the Huskies.
I mean, it was still a reasonably close game because the defense did such a good job in that game. But, I mean, I don't think it's going to be a big factor. But I don't actually think that the Huskies have like a 40% chance of winning. I think I put it like 25 to 30.
I would put it at 20%. They have a 20% chance of winning. We'll see what happens.
I still think that's probably the best odds of beating Oregon at any point within certainly the last 5 years and maybe within this entire streak.
It's definitely the best Husky team that they're going to have faced.
Without question. All right, so let's talk about the Seahawks this week facing Tennessee. Not quite as exciting a matchup, as you pointed out, as Oregon coming to town.
No, and just to quickly kind of recap last week's game, we talked about it more generally, but kind of on a specific level, we talked about potentially being nervous about the linebackers last week. How nervous are you about a couple other things that really kind of reared their ugly heads against Indianapolis? And that was Sidney Rice having a really poor game, and then also Brandon Browner, who was pretty terrible.
Yeah, you know what I would say is that I wasn't surprised by the outcome, especially after Zach Miller didn't play. I expected the Seahawks to lose, but I thought it was going to be a really low-scoring game and that the offense was going to have a tough time because of the offensive line issues. You're without four at that point of your six best blockers, with your tight end also being out. But yet they moved the ball pretty well, largely because of Russell Wilson's ability to make plays with his feet and then, you know, still be able to run the ball against a pretty poor Colts run defense. So to me, the surprise was that the defense had such a hard time getting off the field on third down, and that's where I think it points to a similar thing that we saw last year against Atlanta in the playoffs, that in certain situations, the Legion of Boom is not as dominant as their nickname and their reputation would suggest.
It's true. Passing deep, Indianapolis was 4 for 5 for 140 yards, and they also, with 2 touchdowns, and they also got 2 defensive pass interference calls, one on Browner and one on Sherman that extended drives.
Both crucial.
And then on the offensive side of the ball with Sidney Rice, I want to talk about his catch rate, which is pretty terrible. He's at a 42% catch rate right now compared to the other receivers on the team. Doug Baldwin is at 71%. Golden Tate is at 56%, which I actually thought was kind of low for Golden Tate, considering that he catches so many short passes near the line of scrimmage. And then Jermaine Kearse, who I think we both kind of think should be getting more playing time, probably instead of Sidney Rice, is at an 80% catch rate.
I was surprised actually to see the curse. I think he ended up playing about 25 snaps, something like that. Baldwin played more snaps than Sidney Rice on Sunday. That surprised me.
He did. Curse has had 5 passes thrown to him, has caught 4 of them, has almost as many yards as Sidney Rice.
2 of them gone for touchdowns.
And 1 of them was an interception.
Yeah. Oh, that would be, there were 6 passes then, right? Or was that 1 of the 5?
That's 1 of the 5.
Oh, the offensive pass interference is the 6th. That's what I meant.
Mm.
Yeah. But Curse's DVOA is like 138% right now, which is obviously small sample size, but at some point you got to get him more involved, and especially because he's so effective as a run blocker. That's where I think he brings you an element that Sidney Rice really doesn't. And, you know, Rice, obviously, you can't compare his catch rate to Doug Baldwin's because Baldwin is catching all those intermediate routes and Rice is going deep much more frequently, but that stands out on a team with as good a quarterback and as accurate a quarterback as Russell Wilson. You should not have a catch rate that's in among the weakest receivers playing with terrible quarterbacks in the league.
Yeah, this last week, he had 1 catch for 8 yards on 4 targets. Jermaine Kearse had 1 catch for 28 yards on 1 target for a touchdown. And really, if you consider them as a deep threat, Jermaine Kearse has been a much better deep threat than Sidney Rice has been. I mean, he has 2 long touchdowns and a long pass interference that he caught the ball.
I think part of that probably has to do with the element of surprise, and he's drawing better matchups, and that's the only time the Seahawks are throwing him the ball. But I think at this point he's playing well enough in those opportunities that you have to give a chance to see if he can give you more. But the other thing that stands out is, is Rice become the odd man out when Percy Harvin comes back? Because you're going to want Golden on the Tate on the field. You're going to want Baldwin in the slot. So if you're in a three wide receiver set, is Sidney Rice the guy who's not part of that?
It kind of seems like it. When the Seahawks first traded for Golden Tate, or for Percy Harvin, I think Golden Tate was the one who was most nervous about losing his job. But he's kind of established himself as an essential receiver on the field, especially with broken tackles. I was saying this to you, broken tackle leaders last season, you have Percy Harvin, Marshawn Lynch, and Golden Tate. Three of them are in the top 10 as far as broken tackles for last season. And that's with Percy Harvin missing basically half the season.
The other thing I thought, if we're going back to the Indianapolis game, is I thought the Seahawks did not run the ball enough. I actually thought that about both Seattle teams. The play breakdown was about 2-1 pass to run in both of those games, and the Seahawks were ahead the entire game. They struggled to run the ball more in the second half. The Colts did a much better job. They shut down the read option. But I still think that, you know, they needed to pound a little bit more with Marshawn.
I actually went, you mentioned that to me, and I went and looked at kind of the drive charts on Pro Football Reference to see like if they got to a certain yard line, if they stopped running the ball, and they kind of consistently ran the ball inside. I think that you're confused there. I think that they ran the ball a lot. You're just confusing running with Marshawn Lynch versus running the ball.
Well, a lot of those Wilson's runs were not designed runs, but
it's true. Russell Wilson